We are Two Guys Gaming. As always, even though the music says Two Guys Gaming, this is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this particular series, I am reading and reacting to Project Hail Mary, the novel by Andy Weir. Weir? We'll go with Weir. As mentioned previously, I'm taking a bit of a break from The Burning God because that book series is heavy. I wanted something a little bit lighter, and this ties into the movie that is releasing at the end of this week, if you're listening to this in the week of March 16th, 2026. This particular series is going to be a four-parter where I review the book in four parts, and then I will do a movie versus at the end. I know I still owe you a movie versus for Jurassic Park. What's funny about that is we've watched Jurassic Park twice over the past couple of weeks, once as a family, well, me, my wife, and our son Quinn, and then we went into Connecticut this past weekend to watch it as a live symphony orchestra played the soundtrack. That was really cool. If you ever get a chance to see something like that, definitely take the chance. So after the movie versus, we'll get back to The Burning God, finish that out with the last three episodes, do the movie versus for Jurassic Park, and then that opens us up for the next book, which I think is Red Mars. It's in the show notes, and I will verify it before the end of this particular podcast. The format for this particular series is that I will give the summary from supersummary.com. Again, not a plug necessarily, I just like what they do, and I've been using them for the last few books to give the summary. And then I will give my thought on the book, which is, in this case, mainly just going to be a stream of consciousness discussion of what I found interesting about the book. And maybe I will look forward to see how they cover certain things in the movie before I do the movie versus. Okay, I think that's it for introduction right now. Without any further ado, this is the summary for chapters 1 through 8 in Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. Chapter 1, Summary. In the near future, middle school science teacher and molecular biologist Dr. Ryland Grace wakes up in the dormitory of the Hail Mary interstellar spaceship. Spoiler alerts, all of them! Experiencing total amnesia, Grace has no idea who or where he is and assumes he is in a high-tech hospital as he is connected to an IV, a catheter, and many sensors. Grace feels weak and groggy, but is otherwise in excellent physical condition and attempts to remove his IV. A computerized voice asks for his name, and robotic arms extend from the ceiling to reattach his IV and sedate him when he is unable to answer. Grace regains consciousness while being tended to by the robotic arms. He rolls off the bed to escape, ripping out his catheter in the process. A quote-unquote thin red line of blood causes a memory to flash through his mind. While eating at a San Francisco diner, Grace gets an email from an Astronomy Curiosities message board. Russian scientist Dr. Irina Petrova has discovered a, quote, faint but detectable line, end quote, of infrared light emission stretching in an arc from the top of the sun to Venus. Grace explores the dormitory, dodging the robotic arms. He finds the desiccated corpses of a man and a woman in the other two beds, presumably long dead. Grace concludes that each of them was put into a coma and maintained by the robotic arms, but only he survived. Grace climbs to a hatch out of the dormitory, but falls from the ladder with exhaustion. The robotic arms catch him and return him to his bed, where he falls asleep, despite sensing a quote-unquote wrongness to how he fell. When Grace wakes up, the robotic arms bring him a tube of unexpectedly delicious food. Grace demands more, but the computer tells him that the, quote, food allotment for this meal has been met, end quote. Energized by the meal, Grace gets up and makes a toga with his bedsheet. The robotic arms allow him to climb through the hatch into a laboratory, where the bolted down equipment reminds Grace that he is a scientist. Grace attempts to open another hatch and continue exploring, but the computer refuses to unlock it until he confirms his name, which he can't remember. He falls again and experiences the same sense of quote-unquote wrongness as before. Grace times how long it takes for a test tube to fall from the lab table to the floor, remembering the formula for gravity easily. The test shows that gravity is 1.5 times stronger than it should be, and Grace realizes that he is not on Earth. A frightened Grace tries to think of other explanations for the heightened gravity. Grace makes a simple pendulum and uses physics to determine that he can't be on Earth, on another planet, or in a centrifuge, because of how large the centrifuge would have to be and how fast it would have to spin to achieve 1.5 Gs. Wondering how he knows so much about space, Grace guesses that he works for NASA and has another memory flash. In the memory, Grace meets his friend Marissa, a government scientist, for dinner. Marissa is visibly upset and tells Grace that a Japanese solar probe has determined that the sun is getting exponentially dimmer at the same rate that the Petrova line of infrared light emission is getting brighter. Although the probe caught the problem early, quote, the Petrova line is stealing energy from the sun, end quote. The dimming sun will cause a new ice age, crop failures, and mass starvation. The U.S. president will announce the dilemma with other world leaders the next day. Back on the Hail Mary, Grace realizes that his mission is to solve the Petrova problem and prevent the sun from dying. Grace sobs as he is flooded with memories of the other two crew members, now the corpses in the dormitory, and realizes that only he survived the suspended animation they were put in for the interstellar journey. The computer announces another mealtime, and Grace is again comforted by the food. Grace acclimates to the ship, requesting water from the computer, and finding a zero-G toilet that has been strangely modified for use in gravity. Attempting to remember something on purpose, Grace recalls a televised NASA livestream of Project Arclight, funded jointly by the United States, the European Union, Russia, China, India, and Japan. Project Arclight was developed to determine the cause of the Petrova problem by collecting samples and data from the Petrova line near Venus. On TV, NASA scientists received the first data from the unmanned space probe Arclight. The images show black dots that look and move like microbes, suggesting that the Petrova line may comprise an alien life form. Grace is pulled from this memory by the computer warning him of a quote-unquote angular anomaly, but in order to find the control room and solve the problem, he has to remember his name to open the hatch out of the lab. Grace combs through the NASA livestream memory for clues and realizes that he is a junior high school teacher from San Francisco. Chapter 3, Summary. Grace remembers a particular day teaching his science class. He's a popular teacher, and his students enjoy his lightning round style quiz. After school, Ava Stratt appears in his classroom. Formerly with the European Space Agency, Stratt now leads the Petrova Task Force, a secret international project to solve the Petrova problem and save humanity. Stratt has been granted absolute authority and total immunity by the United Nations. Stratt informs Grace that he has been selected to evaluate the Petrova line samples captured by the Arclight probe because of a paper he wrote when he was still a molecular biologist. The paper, quote, an analysis of water-based assumptions and recalibration of expectations for evolutionary models, end quote, challenges the widely held, quote-unquote, Goldilocks zone theory, which assumes that life is dependent on liquid water and could therefore only exist within a narrow temperature range. The controversial paper cost Grace his academic funding, and he refuses the Petrova Task Force assignment, claiming that he is now happier as a teacher. Later, FBI agents apprehend him at home and escort him to a secret laboratory. At the lab, Stratt explains that the black dots seem to be a life form that is rapidly eating the sun, and so they can't be water-based or else they would be destroyed by the sun's heat. Despite Grace's rejection from the field, he is still considered by other speculative extraterrestrial biology experts to be the most qualified to examine the samples. Stratt leaves Grace to get to know his new lab and assignment. Having finally recalled his name, Grace unlocks the hatch to the Hail Mary's control room. The monitor showed the ship is traveling at a much higher velocity than expected, but Grace can't determine where he is headed. He recognizes the Hail Mary mission crest, which includes the names of his crewmates, Yalizhi and Olesya Ilyukina. Grace suppresses painful memories of his friends by trying to remember his first encounter with the Petrova line samples instead. In his memory, Stratt and an international military coalition watch from an observation room as Grace opens the sample capsule from the arc light. The sample has been transported in a sealed container of non-reactive argon for safety, and the lab is also pumped full of argon, requiring Grace to wear a hazmat suit and an oxygen tank while working. Strat is impatient, but Grace determines very little at first. The black dots absorb X-rays, can't be vaporized, and are unaffected by temperature. By comparing the movement of the black dots to their infrared emissions, Grace hypothesizes that they consume energy and emit light as a method of propulsion. Grace concludes that the life form is an invasive species in Earth's solar system, consuming the sun exponentially as their population grows. Grace names the black dots astrophage, from the Greek for quote-unquote sun eater. Back in the Hail Mary's control room, Grace realizes that the star on the monitor is rotating too quickly to be the Earth's sun, and that he must be in another solar system. Chapter 4 Summary. Grace panics at the realization that he's in another solar system until he notices a monitor in the control room labeled quote-unquote astrophage. Grace deduces that the Hail Mary is using astrophage as fuel and recalls another memory from the secret Petrova Task Force lab. After days of unsuccessful experiments, Grace punctures an astrophage cell with a microscopic needle, killing it and destroying its light-blocking properties. Grace tests the dead astrophage and discovers that it is mostly made up of water, but is able to survive by somehow maintaining a constant temperature of 96.41 degrees Celsius. Grace goes to the ship's supply room to find clothing, and the embroidered names on the crew uniforms help him remember his crewmate's personality. The stern but reasonable Commander Yao, Alessia Ilyukina, the mission's cheerful engineer. He gives Yao and Ilyukina a space burial via the airlock container in the control room. In flashback, Grace remembers his first day back teaching after his secret experiments in the Petrova Task Force lab. His students ask him to explain the Petrova problem, which has become global news. Grace is astounded at how little his students' parents have explained to them, compares the catastrophic potential of the astrophage infestation over the next 30 years to climate change. Grace panics as he imagines his students dying of hunger in a future that is far closer than they imagine it to be. He rushes back to the secret lab and demands to continue working with remaining astrophage samples, which are being divided among all labs all over the world. Back on the Hail Mary, Grace discovers four quote-unquote beetle probes named John, Paul, George, and Ringo, which are designed to be sent back to Earth with findings from the mission. Grace discovers that he only has enough fuel for another 40 days, not nearly enough for a four-year journey back to Earth, and that he's on a lethal, one-way mission. Chapter 5, Summary. In a flashback, Grace recounts his own experiments on astrophage as scientists around the world race to learn about the extraterrestrial life form, which resembles a single-celled organisms on Earth. While trying to determine why they are attracted to Venus, Grace accidentally breeds more astrophage. He hypothesizes the entire astrophage life cycle. The astrophage gather energy from the sun, then use that energy to migrate to Venus, where the carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere supports their asexual reproduction, and then the parent and daughter cells migrate back to the sun to repeat the cycle. Grace calls Strat to give her the news, and she immediately has them escorted via several consecutive military helicopters and fighter jets to a Chinese aircraft carrier in the middle of the South China Sea. There, Strat has Grace report his findings to a, quote, international body of high-level scientists and political operatives, end quote, whom Strat has gathered for a mission called Project Hail Mary. Grace explains how he bred the astrophage and how astrophage could be bred on a large scale and enriched with energy. A Chinese scientist reports that her lab has reproduced Grace's results, and Grace is hurried away to rest while the others continue the secret meeting. The next day, Grace meets with Strat, the Chinese scientist, Germany's Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Dmitry Komarov, a Russian scientist. They explain that astrophage infestations have been found on all the stars close to Earth, except for one, Tau Ceti. Komarov has discovered that astrophage stores energy by converting it to mass, and is designing an interstellar spaceship that uses astrophage as fuel to travel to Tau Ceti and learn why the star is not affected by astrophage. Grace is tasked with breeding enough astrophage for the journey, and due to the dangerous amounts of energy that will be stored in them, parenthetically more than an atomic bomb, and parenthetical, all the work must take place on the aircraft carrier in the middle of the ocean. Chapter 6, Summary. Back in the present, Grace activates the Hail Mary's navigation system and learns that the journey will be complete in 5 days. Once the astrophage power engine is turned off, Grace will be able to use the quote-unquote Petrovascope to search for the signature infrared light emission of astrophage around Tau Ceti. Grace does the math and realizes that because of relativity, he's been traveling for 3 years while at least 13 years have passed on Earth. If Grace is able to successfully send the Beatles probe back, Earth will still have to survive a total of 26 years with a dimming sun, grieving his crewmates and struggling with the psychological burden of bearing responsibility for the survival of the human race. Grace decides to familiarize himself as much as possible with the ship as a distraction. In a flashback, Grace builds an astrophage breeding device. Strat asks Grace his opinion on the dilemma of staffing the three Hail Mary crew members. The cramped quarters and psychological stress of certain death are likely to lead to severe depression and a high risk of suicide. The astronauts could be put in four-year comas, but the health risks are too high. Strat has research from a failed company in Thailand that attempted to induce comas in a chemotherapy patients for the duration of their treatment. The research identifies a genetic sequence that causes coma resistance in humans, but only one in every 7,000 people has the DNA marker, meaning the applicant pool is severely limited. Grace tells Strat she just wants him to confirm what she already knows. She can't mitigate the risks of leaving the crew awake, but humans do have time to develop coma technology, and she should only select applicants with a coma-resistant genetic marker. Back in the present, Grace's memory is improving. He catalogs the lab, explores the extensive reference materials in the lab's computer, and learns how he will eventually launch the Beetle probes. As the Hail Mary reaches its destination point, the engines shut off, and Grace adjusts poorly to zero gravity. He is finally able to turn on the Petroviscope, which was useless while the astrophage-powered engine was on. Grace uses the Petroviscope to identify a Petrova line stretching from Tau Ceti to one of the star's planets, but an unidentified object partially obscures his view. There is an alien spaceship within a few hundred meters of the Hail Mary. Spoiler alert again, jeez. These guys give a crazy spoiler summary. I wrote things down that was like, he thought it was maybe another Earth ship beforehand, but whatever. Grace names the alien spaceship, quote-unquote, Blip A, after the readout on the monitor, and calculates that the Blip A is roughly three times larger than the Hail Mary, and constructed from broad, flat faces like a many-faceted diamond. Poor shape for efficient flight or containing atmospheric pressure. The Blip A is also astrophage-powered, displaying a steady glow on the Petroviscope. Grace flashes its engines to signal Blip A, which signals back, indicating that there is intelligent life aboard. The Blip A pulls alongside the Hail Mary, and Grace makes out a hull-mounted robot on the alien ship. The robot tosses a cylinder to the Hail Mary, and Grace determines it will reach him in 40 minutes, giving him just enough time to prepare for a spacewalk to retrieve it. Grace speculates on whether the aliens will be friendly, but feels reassured by the effort that the aliens are making to communicate. Grace finds that he is very comfortable on the spacewalk, or EVA, and assumes he must have some astronaut training. He retrieves the cylinder sent from the Blip A, which is the same model tan color as the Blip A's hull, and about the size and shape of a coffee can. Back inside the Hail Mary, the cylinder is too hot to handle, despite having traveled through freezing cold space, and reeks of ammonia. Grace leaves the cylinder in the airlock to cool, and let the ammonia spell dissipate, tries to remember how to use the lab equipment on the ship, which will only work in Earth's gravity. Chapter 8, Summary. In a flashback, Grace travels with Strat to Geneva, Switzerland, to meet Dr. Locken, a Norwegian climatologist. Locken and Grace are initially combative, as Locken has poor opinion of Grace from his controversial paper, and Grace and Locken argue about whether Earth life and astrophage share a common biological ancestor. Locken has been trying to reach Strat after hearing that Strat intended to develop special lab equipment to work in zero gravity. Knowing that the rushed development of specialized equipment is likely to fail or have inaccurate results, Locken proposed that the Hail Mary be designed, divide in half, and transform into a giant centrifuge, creating the gravity necessary for the more reliable existing lab equipment to function properly. Grace agrees that Locken's transforming centrifuge ship design is better than risking poorly designed zero gravity versions of very sensitive equipment. Strat drafts Locken to design the Hail Mary, despite her protests. In the present, aboard the Hail Mary, Grace locates the controls for transforming the ship into a centrifuge to achieve Earth gravity, or 1G. After transformation, Grace notices that the Blip A is mimicking the Hail Mary's spinning and jokes that he is glad to be a part of the quote-unquote first miscommunication with intelligent extraterrestrials. In the lab, Grace determines that the alien cylinder is made of pure xenon, which should be physically impossible as xenon is a gas at room temperature. The xenon cylinder is impenetrable, but Grace notices a seam and is able to unscrew the lid, albeit in the opposite direction he expects. Inside the cylinder is a tiny scale model of the local star system, with one star and a planet having a Petrova line arcing between them. Grace determines from the model that the aliens are from a planet near the star 40 Iridani, which is also experiencing astrophage infestation. Grace names the alien race Iridians and the solid xenon material Xenonite. Grace solders a line between Tau Ceti and Sol, Earth's sun, on the model, and adds a paraffin wax Petrova line arcing towards Venus, hoping to communicate that he and the Iridians are Tau Ceti for the same reason. Grace transitions the Hail Mary out of centrifuge modes and suits up to do another EVA and throw the cylinder back to the Blip A. Several hours pass before the Blip A tosses back a new cylinder, this time aiming the delivery right into the Hail Mary's airlock, making things easier on Grace, who waves to the Blip A's hull robot. Inside the new cylinder is a model of the Blip A and the Hail Mary connected by a tube. Grace realizes that the aliens want to meet. Holy cow, that is quite the summary, and spoiler-filled like hell. You guys know that we're not normally too concerned about spoilers here at Two Generations Gaming, but even I would have liked to have kept some of those things a little bit on the secret side just to make the discovery that much better. But what are you going to do? I didn't really want to take the time to write the summary myself either, so we get what we get, and it's a good summary, so we'll stick with that. Okay, if you've been listening, you know that I like to do my reactions differently depending on the book. In the last book, The Burning God, I generally come up with either some quotes or ideas that stick with me based on what I read, and I talk about them. This time around, I came up with three different clusters that sort of tie the different chapters together. First 1 through 3, then 4 through 6, and finally chapters 7 and 8, where we get to the end of this particular section in my reading, well, listening to, of the book. I personally like how Weir set up the first part of the book and established the storytelling, where he goes from what's happening in the present to what happens in the past. Initially, it happens by accident because he notices the thin red line, and then that reminds him of the thin red line of the Petrova line. And then from there, we're off and running to discovering new things about him each chapter, both in the present and in the past. It's kind of cool to have those parallel story arcs going with one another. The amnesia thing, I mean, it's a little overdone, but it does work. I mean, it drops you right in there. You have no idea what's going on because Grace has no idea what's going on, and the two of you kind of have to figure out what's going on together. I mean, I think I said it before, they're cliches because they work, right? And people just keep going back to them. As far as the science goes, as I was reading, something popped in my head. I started calling him the dollar store Michael Crichton. And I mean that in the best possible way. Crichton, when he writes his books, obviously he writes them based on science and gives it the backup of the science always works well. It's the capitalism and the greed that gets into the way. Whereas Weir takes the science, and I think he writes it at an appropriate level for people being introduced to the different ideas. It's not too high, but it's also not dumbed down to a point. You know, he talks about gravity and he brings in the idea of pendulums and the gravitational constant that you can actually discover if you use a particular formula, S equals 1/2 AT squared. I've actually used that formula in the past when my family and I went to the library at UMass Amherst, which is famously large, tall, and there's other stories behind it. Maybe I'll talk about it later when they start getting into the engineering part of the book, engineering the ship and everything, because it's an engineering problem that you would expect, or an engineering story that you might expect. Anyway, we were on the 26th floor, I think it is. They tell you to go up to the 26th floor because you can get a view of the entire area as you walk around the 26th floor. And my kids asked me if you would die if you fell from that height. And I answered, I don't know, but what I can tell you is how fast you would be going when you hit the ground. And I did all that math in my head as we were walking, and I told them, and then they asked about how big a net would have to be, because that's the way kids are, right? You give them an idea or a fact, and they take that fact and run with it. So I thought that was pretty cool that he brought in those two things from physics as Grace was figuring everything out. The dollar store Michael Crichton line came to me while we were watching Jurassic Park in Waterbury, Connecticut, while an orchestra played the theme music, as I said earlier. And I thought Michael Crichton does the same thing with the science, but he just does it at such a different level that even people who are reading the book might be confused by some of the things that he's talking about and why he's talking about them in the context of the book. But Weir doesn't leave any of that to the imagination. He just kind of gives it to you. The other thing that kind of jarred me about the whole thing is the way Weir gets a little bit too cutesy with the character. Like, the guy is always ready with some kind of wry comment or witticism. For me, it just pulls me out of the fiction a little bit and makes me roll my eyes on occasion. I mean, don't get me wrong, I still like the book. I'm obviously listening to it a second time around. I want to go see the movie because I think it's going to be really good based on who's involved in it. Except that part of it, it just gets to me for some reason. I don't like those kinds of characters if they're in a real situation like this. Like, I didn't mind it in Buffy so much because Buffy was already weird and fantastic and they had kind of set it up like that, but it just feels jarring for some reason in something like this. I'm not sure 100% why. I guess it's just something I have to deal with. This is most evident in the cool teacher, quote unquote, comment that he makes. As I was reading that, I was thinking this is somebody who obviously hasn't taught before because that concept of a quote unquote cool teacher simply doesn't exist, at least not in the way that he's showing it. It only exists in fiction as people who remember teachers that they had who were either kind to them or supportive or had some specific quirk that allowed them to remember the teacher, that they remember them as a quote unquote cool teacher. But I think it was Family Guy who dealt with this, where Peter goes back to the school and he meets up with his former cool science teacher and realizes that guy was absolutely fucking crazy and he was just looking at it through a teenage lens that had never properly been able to mature past that. So that's the other thing that really took me out of the whole fiction for a bit. I'm like, yeah, that's not the way this works. I mean, it's a minor part of the plot, but being a teacher myself, you can see how that might stick in my craw a little bit. The chapter 4 brought me to the quote unquote "we're fucked" of it all. I was listening to a podcast about the war in Iran and closing the Strait of Hormuz, and I went upstairs for some reason. I think I was putting my clothes away in my closet, or I was grabbing something out of my closet, and I just said to my wife, that's exactly what I said to her. I said, we're fucked. And she said, the US, the country? And I said, no, I think at this point, it's going to be the whole world. Like, this whole thing could potentially disrupt the entire world economy. And obviously, that's not a great thing. So, I guess just like reading The Burning God and having that connect to real life, this might actually be good because this is a much more hopeful look at the end of humanity and civilization, and perhaps that will help me to get through these next couple of weeks, months, however long it takes for this all to shake down. Oh, another part of the book that hit me that Andy Weir obviously is not Michael Crichton is his writing of the world scientists and politicos during the meeting. As I was listening to it, it might have just been because the person reading the book, because I'm listening to an audiobook, used accents to get things across, but the whole thing just felt, it just stunk of stereotypes of the different countries. Like, the Germans were rigid and timely and all those sorts of things. And the Chinese had spies, so they figured out how things worked before everybody else did. In Russian, he offers them vodka as a drink, and I don't know, that whole part just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Again, not enough to get me to put the book down, but just something that I noticed as I was reading. He definitely leans on some tropes and simple ideas to get his point across sometimes, which is kind of frustrating. This is also about the time that I started to make connections between the movie coming out. Part of the book is flashbacks, especially the part of them flying him. I didn't know if that was going to be a montage, sort of like one of those breakneck montages where you just go, now you're on a plane, now you're here, now you're on a helicopter, now you're here, now you're on a plane, now you're here, now you're here. And at the end, all wrapped up, and he's sitting in a meeting listening to somebody drone on before he finally snaps into place. Just thought about how are they going to approach that in the movie during the whole thing. One thing I will say positively about this particular section is I liked the whole part where he was doing the research and trying to figure out where the astrophage was going and how it knew to go where it needed to go. I thought that was a cool application of the scientific process in that particular scene, which was nice to see. And I think that's what brings me back to the book, is that the science, for the most part, the science is strong, even if the characters are overall weak, other than the main character. There's also the puke scene. As I was listening to that, he spends an inordinate amount of time with that, which I guess makes sense, but I just kind of put in my notes, puke, ooh, how are they going to do that in the movie? And how is the audience going to react to that? Probably in the same way. Ew! I can just hear it now. Anyway, that is my thoughts on the second part, the chapter 4 through 6, the whole we're fucked, hopeful, science is decent, the puke scene is gross, and let's get to the meat of the book and the first contact. I said in the summary, as I was reading, that in my own notes, I wrote something down about how he initially thought that it might be another human ship, another Earth ship that they sent in addition to his ship. And then he worked out that it was most likely an alien ship. He attempts to communicate and succeeds by using the thrust on his ship. And I thought that was pretty cool that they communicated initially using that. My main thought here is I don't know if I could be able to be as detached as he was about the whole thing. You're meeting an alien for the first time, and I'd probably be freaking the fuck out. But then again, he's also sort of come to the conclusion earlier that he's going to die on this mission, so perhaps that's why he's able to be so calm and collected about it, is that it's like, well, everything that's going on here is kind of crazy and wild, so why wouldn't I meet an alien while I'm out here, you know? Also, he does think what others among us might think, that is the alien friendly? Is it an enemy? Does it want to eat me? I think he actually says that in the book, if I remember correctly. And that's much more relatable because you have no idea, right? Like, we're always sold the book of goods about how aliens are trying to conquer us or eat us or destroy our planet or whatever it is, because of that whole xenophobic streak that humans have, that something that looks different from us must want to kill us or end us or what have you. But he does come to the conclusion that when you have a common enemy, that has a tendency to bring people together. And in this case, the nice thing is that the common enemy is actually something that we can agree is not a great thing. It's not like the common enemy in real life, which, as we're seeing with the war in Iran, the common enemy is other people who are just trying to live their lives like we are, and we are bombing them. So, yeah, moving on, let's get to something a little more hopeful, happy. I don't know. Arctan. How many of you remember what Arctangent is? I do because I'm a math teacher and occasionally I teach geometry slash pre-calculus. I thought it was cool that they did a little Arctan drop-in during one of the scenes. You know, as a math teacher, that just kind of stuck out to me. So I think that about covers what I had written down in my notes about the book. I do wonder a few things about the movie. How do you make the parts with just Grace by himself entertaining and engaging to get people to stick with you and root for this guy? I don't know much about Ryan Gosling as an actor other than he was in Barbie and he actually played the role of Ken pretty well, so maybe he'll be able to carry the movie. I can't think of anybody else who I would put in this particular role. Maybe I'll think about it and we can talk about that in a future episode, maybe in the movie versus after I see the movie. Maybe I'll be able to think of somebody else who could have done it. Who knows? Maybe he'll absolutely nail it and I'll be completely wrong about this. Next time, we will cover chapters 9 through 16 of the book. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us, if you haven't already, at www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles. I've been doing a deep dive on season 2 of Fallout. I'm up to season 2, episode 6, so I will be done with that by the end of the month. I also started a series for Mario because Mario Day happens in March, March 10th. The first article was an interview with the quote-unquote first Goomba, one of history's most prolific serial killers. And the second one is the first in a three-part series about the Blue Shell Brigade. I wrote their manifesto, and in future episodes, articles, I will infiltrate the Blue Shell Brigade and tell you all about it. There is also a link to our socials, our YouTube, which I just put up a video of me pretending to be a druid sitting outside of the Tomb of Horrors for my following in Wade Wilson's footsteps from Ready Player One. There's also other videos there, a couple about hidden gems on certain consoles. I did the Atari 2600 and the Nintendo Entertainment System. There will be a couple of deep dives, one already about Hero, the other about Kickle Cubicle for the NES. Then I'm going to move on to the Sega Master System and the Intellivision for the next couple of months. I've also been doing a playthrough of the Sundial Games calendar. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's an RPG a day calendar, and I play through it, and I have a scenario that I set up where there is a signal coming through and various AIs are decoding the signal and giving the updates every week. After all that, there's also a link to our TikTok, which I try to post to about 3 times a day. I just put up something about the latest miniature that I finished, and I got a lot of engagement, something like 30 likes and 5 or 6 comments that I responded to. I also put things about my Lego and a puzzle if I'm doing it. I think that's about all I have to plug for right now. This was a crazy long episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I will see you in a week with part 2 of Project Hail Mary. Talk to you then. Bye, guys.
We are two guys gaming.